What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. I can remember the signs on a lot of front lawns. Thank you so much. Hip, hip, hooray, we said to our frontline workers. They were keeping us fed. They were educating our children, and they were caring for us when we needed help during the pandemic. We even gave them a name, essential workers. But now, as the emergency has ebbed, are we paying them enough or even thanking them enough? For that moment in time, America was waking up to a workforce that had gotten too little attention for many decades. Where are we now? Are they still essential? That's today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Jamie McCallum, and he is a sociology professor at Middlebury College. He's written a book called Essential, How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight for Worker Justice. And I've got to tell you, Professor, when I thought about essential, the only time I had heard that term before the pandemic was basically about our state workers here in my state of Connecticut, whenever we'd have a terrible blizzard or some big weather event. The state workers who did not need to come in that day were called non-essential. I had never heard workers called essential before. I guess most of us sense that we all are essential.
Yes, that is correct. The term was not popular before COVID hit our country. In the book, I actually go to some length to explain that despite that designation, essential workers have always been with us, perform duties that are obviously necessary for the success and health and wealth and well-being of the general population. It's about probably a third to half of economic activity, depending how you slice the pie and what you consider to be essential or not. Obviously, during the pandemic, this took on a heightened quality, so we learned sort of who these people were. And, you know, that sort of subjective designation gave them a whole new cultural and social meaning in American life. But the jobs they're doing right now are the same jobs they were doing then. And, you know, the essential designation sort of came and went. But I think part of my book is to say, look, let's not forget about that thing, about that time, and make sure that we still value these people as what they are, as essential.
Well, ironically, as your book clearly points out, they were anything but essential because they were, well, maltreated in many ways, forced into situations that were very hazardous and dangerous. And a lot of these people are what you term the new servant class in America.
That term obviously is fairly loaded. And servants in the sense that, you know, they are essentially, like, we have a class of people in America whose job it is to be at the beck and call of everybody else. And that class did not just appear. Like, it came on the scene slowly after the 2008-2009 recession when we eliminated a huge chunk of middle wage jobs and created a gig economy and created an on-demand economy and, you know, created, you know, we have more personal servants, personal dog walkers, personal chefs, personal massage therapists than we ever have. And during the pandemic, those people either became laid off and lost everything or they became frontline workers and risked their lives. So it's a class of people that was essentially sort of produced or came into being in the not so distant past to some extent. I mean, we've always had nurses, et cetera, doctors, but those other people, they were not as numerous and did not take up as large a chunk of the economy as they do now.
By the way, you started the book with a story that reminded me about how quickly our memories fade, because it was such a moving account of Kim Monich, the nurse in New York City, to really remind us about how dangerous it was, her story of this traveling nurse in New York City with two masks, a face shield, a gown, gloves, goggles, and there she was drowning in her own sweat. Why did you start with that story?
It was actually the first interview I did, which is weird because I've done hundreds. So it was one of those things where when I went back to my notes, it occurred to me that, like you just said, we would have to remember this time. Like, our Americans' memories are pretty short. Yes, we lived through a pandemic. Now, you know, most of us are acting like it never happened. I wanted to remind people, like, what we went through and what some people went through who were on the front lines was, against their will or not, risking their lives to save others. In that opening vignette, Kim working on her patient, a code for 3 hours, and then that patient dies. It was, you know, when I talked to her, the story sounds pretty dramatic, but actually when she tells it, it was like one of 10 stories, you know, that she had about that night. So in her mind, it actually didn't really resonate at all. It was just like one of a number. I heard a lot of those stories throughout the, when I did my interviews, and to be honest, most of them did not make the book, because at a certain point, I think I did become desensitized to hearing so much either trauma or what people might, you know, refer to as heroism. And so in some ways, I tried to limit that to some extent then, but as the book has come out, a lot of people have referred to that and said, you know, I almost forgot how bad that stuff was, even some nurses.
You know, it's fascinating. We had all these signs on our front lawns about the heroes, and we thank you so much. And yet we also often see stories, and we're recording this around the holiday season. And, of course, when we mistreat a lot of the people who are on the front lines because we're so intent on getting the product we want or the service we want just in time for the holidays, I just want to remind people, of course, we saw the way that those who were flying airplanes and those who were attending to us on airplanes were treated during that period. We are talking about a whole range of people who didn't have the option of staying at home and doing their work. Many of the new technology workers, those who have advanced degrees and such. We're talking about a lot of healthcare workers, education, food services, retail, logistics, leisure, hospitality. Was there one group of people that you looked upon and said, that was miraculous what they did, particularly the way they're treated by their employers?
I mean, I think the thing to remember is, like, work in any economy is not like, it's not really done by individuals. Like, it's done by classes. Like, nurses sort of stole the show to some extent early on, but, like, nurses couldn't do their jobs if janitors didn't do their jobs. And if orderlies didn't do their jobs, or people in the morgue didn't also do their jobs. So what I think more than anything is that there was a network of people who worked more or less together, even not unknowingly, but it's the same way it happens at any time, who were part of, like, a network or a class or a group. And, you know, one thing that I talk about in the book is slowly but surely how that group of people came to recognize each other as frontline workers or as essential workers. Like, they began to see themselves as a class, like an American working class that's different from what we typically think. Because we typically think of the working class as this portion of the workforce that makes X number of dollars per year and has graduated from college or hasn't graduated from college, whatever it is. And during the pandemic, those kinds of designations didn't really make sense. You had nurses and janitors and delivery drivers and doctors and mailroom clerks and retail checkout people at the grocery store, all sort of, like, you know, representing each other. And they were at each other's picket lines. They were at each other's protests. They understood themselves to have a common bond, and that was their proximity to risk. If you went outside every day and risked getting COVID so the rest of us could live and eat, well, then you were part of them. And if you weren't, if you did not do that, then you were not. And there's some exceptions to that characterization, but I think overall that exposure to risk or proximity to risk was the driving factor for how essential workers saw themselves and saw each other.
And I think you said in the book that about 3,500 healthcare workers died during the pandemic, and they were the ones who not only really took the brunt in terms of their own physical well-being, but they also were the ones who held the most in terms of protests and struck and formed unions, that they really took it upon themselves to make their concerns, their voices known because, as you say, of their proximity to death.
Nurses definitely died at high rates. So did nursing home care workers. So did home health aides. The fact is the American government, the CDC, does not collect data on health and occupation. You know, we don't know, like, how many meat packers died of COVID who got it at work. We don't really know. Like, we have rough estimates. But nurses, we did count. I don't really know why we counted some and not others, but we counted them, so we know. So that's sort of a standout figure. But in reality, the COVID whipped through meatpacking plants like it was as if that was the whole point. And, you know, there were very few things, government interventions, unions, whatnot, to stop it. And so I think that, you know, if we could really go back in time, there was probably a fair amount of death and destruction there that would come close to what nurses faced.
And let's be honest about this. What we're talking about is coming in the wake of a period in American history where there was an end of loyalty. Workers, such as the ones that we're talking about, until that point were largely invisible, undervalued, underpaid, underrepresented. They were really being taken advantage of in so many ways. And that's not to say that they're not still being taken advantage of, but they did raise their voices and their heads above the din for a period of time and said, look at me, look at what I'm doing, and how would you survive without what it is that I'm putting at risk?
You know, we don't typically think of American workers as particularly, you know, militant or whatever, class conscious. As you mentioned a minute ago, if you look at the stats on strikes in 2020, you will see that there are eight. That's what the government tells you. Eight large strikes. The government collects data on large strikes, which is a strike with 1,000 people or over. And in a typical year, there is far more. So it looks like nothing was happening. So, but when I started talking to people and interviewing people, almost everyone toward the, even if I wasn't asking about it, would say, oh yeah, by the way, there was a strike yesterday. Or by the way, there was a protest or a sit-in or a slowdown or a stick out or whatever it was. There was all these like small little actions and job actions and protests and walkouts happening that were far below the radar of the official story. And so to some extent, the point of the book is to like elevate those voices and to say, yes, the American working class is weak in a lot of ways. And it's disorganized. But when push comes to shove in 2020 and 2021, workers really took matters into their own hands. And I think some of that spirit, that like sort of militant activity, has translated over into what we're seeing today, which is an explosion of labor organizing like we haven't seen in quite a bit.
Okay, so labor in America, just to remind people, went from a very high number in the private sector to a very low number from the 70s on through the Great Recession into the pandemic. I think it ended up falling to about 8% of all private level workers being organized. And that's a result of a lot of changes in American society that really put the power in the hands of employers. And you tell us that the pandemic illustrated why we should all care about workers' rights, even in good times. So we talked about the memory that Americans have, which is very short. Are we still on the side of the worker? Do we still see that, or have we moved on already? Have we made any real systemic changes?
This is a point of endless debate. And I think there's a few ways to think about it. So yes, like Americans showed up in vocal support for working class people, which basically doesn't happen that often. Did that translate into real material better conditions for workers? They got hazard pay for a while. They got expanded unemployment. They were given extra PPE here and there. Aside from that, I would say nurses, nursing home aides, retail clerks, meatpacking workers, etc., are more or less still working in the same exact kinds of jobs that they were 2.5 years ago. And I think that is an incredible failure on the part of the American state to step up and say, actually, like, yes, people deserve, like, 100%, everyone in America deserves federal funded, paid sick leave, medical leave, family medical leave. Like, all these things that became useful during the pandemic to workers, we should have kept them. And, you know, we did not keep it, I think, at our own peril. As you said, the conditions of essential workers, their working conditions, are our living conditions. It is crucial for us to understand that, like, very simple matter of interdependence. Like, if they're safer, we're safer. If they have better jobs, we get better care. And I think that for a while we recognize that, you know, not just because of short-term memory, but because of an interest from corporate America in short-term profits, we did not make the kinds of changes politically on a grand scale that would really transform work in this country. And that is a vulnerability that we will transmit into the future.
Jamie McCallum is with us. The book is called Essential: How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight for Worker Justice. And it is a long fight, and it is ongoing. One of the things that has happened is that we have a worker shortage, we're told, in America. And therefore, people are valued a bit more simply because the cost of replacing them is much higher. Therefore, there are many companies that have really had to stretch a bit and say, you know, we've got to be a little less penurious with these people. We've got to give some more money. We don't want to keep having to replace the same person. So just out of self-interest, is there some value and some benefit going on, even if the government came in at this really difficult moment under both the Trump and Biden administrations, threw some money on the table, and then that has been pulled back, or some policies that were of some benefit, like the child tax credit and such,
right,
and now we're pulling back again. That's more our default position in America. But what is this worker shortage doing to help raise some standards within the working situation?
Wages went up a little bit. The labor shortage definitely drove wages up a little bit. However, if they went up less than, say, 16%, given inflation, you still got a pay cut, you know, over the last year. And that's bad. Second of all, we have a labor shortage, sort of. The other way to look at it, which I think is more productive, is that we actually just have a surplus of bad jobs. We have tons of jobs that people, you know, employers want to fill and workers either don't want to do or can't do for other reasons. And the other reasons are actually really important. Like, we recovered about 80% of our child care capacity post-pandemic. A lot of child care places shut down, which means there's 20% of people who previously used child care and now can't, and that means they can't go to work. It's the same with elder care. So there's a lot of people who are still caught in a care crisis and can't work. The other thing is, though, like, in capitalist economies, we have a pretty easy solution to labor shortages: money. So, like, we have a nursing shortage, right? If you offered nurses $1 million, you'd have a nursing surplus tomorrow. And if you think $1 million is too much, well, how much is the right amount? Right? Like, we have an economy that right now does not provide enough jobs to take care of people. Like, just imagine if we had a socialist economy and there was a nursing shortage. Every conservative in the world would point a finger and be like, see, I told you, socialists can't get the job done. Capitalists can't get the job done. Like, it doesn't work. Like, we are getting nickel and dimes in the kinds of jobs that we need to fill that are vital to our health and well-being and longevity. I mean, life expectancy among American men is declining for the first time in, you know, U.S. history, you know? And it's like, so how do we let that happen. And I think one explanation is just that the jobs aren't good enough. We actually don't have a nursing shortage. We have like a significant portion of the world's registered nurses living in America. They just aren't working as nurses because the jobs are so bad that they're leaving the bedside in droves. And that's the kind of solution that really needs like money, care, and political attention thrown at it immediately. And right now, there's just not the will, really, in either party to do those things.
Well, you say that we need to reorganize the working hierarchy so that essential workers are not on the bottom, but rather serve as the foundation for real democracy. That sounds like what, in a sense, President Biden, who said that he is here to reinvigorate unions, has said about building a stronger economy from the middle out rather than the top down. How do you do that? What are the policies that would help to ensure that that is the approach we're taking?
You can start by copying and pasting the kinds of policies that give workers a better deal in our peer countries. Our peer countries are, right now, are places like Palau, a corner of Vietnam. Don't offer paid leave, right? Like, those should not be our peer countries. Our peer countries should be Denmark and Sweden and Germany, that somehow work a 30-hour work week and yet still produce a pretty high standard of living. We can copy and paste some of those policies. And that would, you know, overnight create a situation in which more people can live with dignity without having to work the kind of jobs they currently work. The other thing we can do, obviously, is pass the PRO Act. The PRO Act would be the largest change to American labor law in about 90 years. It would level the playing field so that when workers go to organize a union, they have a fair shot. Right now, we basically have boss law in America. We don't really have labor law. And that reform is vital. And Biden seemed like he was interested in passing it. And he came in with this pro-labor agenda. Like, we had, I mean, to be honest, I was kind of surprised. Everyone was surprised. He's like the next FDR, the next Lincoln. And then all of a sudden, the railroad workers want to go on strike, or, you know, want to pay a couple paid sick days, and he turns his back. And I think that, you know, that is telling. Like, the labor movement knows this. It can't wait for Biden or whoever else, even Bernie, to come along and save them. Like, workers have to organize. And history is a guide here. Like, workers have organized successfully and won things, even when the political situation was not in their favor, i.e. around the New Deal, before the New Deal. And so I think that that time period is worth returning to when thinking about how we can win some basic social democratic reforms out of what is otherwise sort of a hellscape.
Well, we also need to remind ourselves that I think a lot of people's definition of the working class in America, they might picture this burly white teamster, but today it's not that. I know that when I ventured out during the early phase of the pandemic, what struck me was how many people of color and women were there on the front lines doing this really thankless work, whether it was in a grocery store or a restaurant takeout or wherever it might be, that it was predominantly those two groups who were overrepresented.
You don't even have to venture out. I mean, you can just look it up in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Like, you know, who are the people who are disproportionately represented in income, let's say under 60 grand a year, and working in frontline service jobs? They're disproportionately black and brown and women. The other thing about the working, the sort of constitution of the working class also, is that it has also added people at the other end. Like, there are far more workers with master's degrees and PhD dropouts and whoever else than we've ever had. So in that sense, that's why you see the strike wave in at the New School, at the UC system, at Columbia, like at NYU. Like, these places aren't typical what we think of, like, oh, the American working class, but like, they're precarious grad students making 25 grand a year with a master's degree, you know? Like, now those people are working class Americans, and they weren't 25 years ago. And I think that transformation of the working class is much bigger than it used to be, much more diverse than it used to be. the best unions are really realizing this and beginning to understand that, well, we're not just talking about those old white guys in shiny jackets anymore, right? Like, we're talking about a whole new group of people who are also, by and large, more interested in unions than they were even 10 years ago. I mean, I teach college kids. I couldn't pay kids to take my class on labor sociology a decade ago. Now there's a wait list because, like, they understand that, like, unions are like basic social justice organizations. Like, they're on par with Black Lives Matter or on par with civil rights organizations that are, like, out there fighting alongside people who are sort of oppressed on many spectrums. And so the constitution of the working class having shifted really does sort of change the way we should talk and think about them.
The story of the essential workers, you tell us, during the pandemic is part of the long unraveling of the New Deal. And I think a lot of people have missed this story, that from the 70s primarily on through this period, we have seen a real hatchet to these, workers' rights issues. And, there's a party in our country that has been pushing back against what they thought was too organized a group of labor people. You tell us that there is now a worker justice movement that has started. What is the impact of that? And for those of us who aren't really aware of what's going on there, how active is that? How successful do you think that will be?
So if you look at the shadow cast by the New Deal over the 20th century, what you find is a mixed bag of programs and politics that, tended to distribute the wealth that working people produce back to them, and it's something like a fair deal. In other words, like, corporate profits and wages and productivity rose in tandem. In the 70s, that all ended. Corporate profits line keeps going up, the wages line goes flat or declines, and you get a situation we have today where people are working longer with worse benefits at lower paying jobs with longer commutes and with an OSHA apparatus which is less inclined to prosecute employers for poor safety practices. So that's like how we went into the pandemic. And everything that happened during the pandemic just made everything worse that was existing before. So people went in with a low bar. And I think it was a lot of that indignation and resentment really translated into the pandemic labor movement. Today, what I think is different than what it was 3 years ago is that you have groups of people in so many industries that are organizing sort of at the same time. So less siloed by occupation. Like, in 2018, we had a pretty big strike wave, but it was all teachers. Now we have an organizing wave led by tons of different kinds of workers. Amazon folks, baristas at Starbucks, adjuncts at the colleges, John Deere workers in the Midwest, teachers throughout the Northeast, all these different groups of people who have been, impacted by this long sort of unraveling or eroding of our political economy. And so I think that is the biggest change. The pandemic really allowed these different groups to sort of cross-pollinate each other, and including folks outside the workplace. I mean, you have Black Lives Matter now talking about the strike for Black Lives, like using the language of labor to talk about social justice. That kind of activity is not typical for the American labor landscape, and I think its roots really lie in the pandemic.
What is it that the workers that we're seeing who are getting more active are most concerned about? Is it their wages, safety protocols, paid sick days, better health care, or is it a combination of all those things?
To some extent, it does vary by industry, and to some extent, there's like a necessary overlap. Like, so I studied nursing homes a lot. I interviewed tons of nursing home workers, and they all said the same thing. They all said, we know that we are spreading COVID throughout the nursing home to the very patients that we are supposed to be saving, right? And that is because they don't make enough money to work in one home, but they have to work in two or three, which then spread the virus from home to home when they traveled. In that sense, the answer to that is $10 more an hour. That's also a safety factor. It's also a labor time factor. So if you can reduce the time people spend making money, increase the money they spend, they don't have to work at two or three homes, which then increases worker safety. It's really hard to unpack those different things. I mean, yes, like OSHA should do its job more than it has been, but also like OSHA is underfunded and understaffed. The NLRB should do its job, but the NLRB is also like on a shoestring budget. So I think, you know, if we were to bolster those institutions and those things, which means more money and which means higher wages, there's a necessary corollary to like worker safety following this place.
The American generosity that we saw during the pandemic, that seems to be a bit of an aberration from what we saw before it and what we're likely to see the farther away from the crisis we get. Because you say there's been no long-term review of a lot of these worker-related policies in the American governance structure. And if we're not going to do it now, after what we've seen and the shortage of workers we're experiencing, then when?
If you can answer that question, you know, you should write a book about it because no one really knows. I mean, as you said, it turns out that in about 1 month, we found like give or take like $11 or $12 trillion to just toss at a problem. That didn't even come close to solving the problem. That just got us to zero. You know, if you think about the amount of money that billionaires made, or the number of billionaires that increased also, like there was more money in the economy to spend even than we did. And so clearly, if you think about that, like things like a Green New Deal, or things like debt relief, or free your health care, all those things become clear that like we can afford them, there's no political will to do it. And so I think that realization was important to recognize. On the question of, you know, if not now, when, I think the only, which I know is a very unsatisfying answer, but the only answer historically is like when they have to. In other words, when you create a crisis of legitimacy so big for the American state that it is forced to pony up, as in the case of the New Deal. The New Deal was not this benevolent FDR policy thing. Like he was in power a couple of years before he started building WPA high school football stadiums and whatnot and like creating good jobs. Like that was not his thing going into office. He was forced to do that. And so, you know, the pandemic crisis like revealed a pre-existing crisis. To get that kind of social spending for the kinds of things we need, we probably need to create a crisis out of our own power, i.e. mass strikes, mass refusal to cooperate with the system at hand to force concessions. And, you know, I'm an intellectual. That's not me suggesting, you know, people go out and do this. Like the labor movement is sort of aware. It's very hard to do. But I think just if you look at historically, that's the kind of things that give people what they want. And, you know, even the Democratic Party stood against basic labor law reforms. Like the most basic things that even people in the party opposed, Manchin, Sinema being the main ones. And so you're not going to get this kind of thing from on high. It's going to have to come from below. And that
do you see that kind of energy still there or in the sociological studies that are going on about people's attitudes?
No. Yeah, I mean, the attitudes are there. You know, the attitudes are there. Like people understand. I mean, as I think you're pointing to this part of the end of the book when I talk about, you know, support for labor is at an all-time high, support for corporations at an all-time low. That's all well and good, but, like, no one's in a union. You know, no one, there's very few people who are in a position of power to take advantage of that attitudinal shift, except maybe elected officials, and they're not going to do it. So attitudes are one thing. It's almost like, you know, if people started – you know, striking tomorrow and I, you know, it's like, it's tough to imagine really realistically what that would take. You'd have to strike in essential key industries and be very strategic about it. That would really drive a crisis. It's extraordinarily hard and difficult to imagine that happening anytime soon. So I think it's not just a matter of like, you know, people's feelings or attitudes or sentiments shifting. we really need to take advantage and put those attitudes and feelings into action. And that level of organization to do that is, you know, it's so far, honestly, it just doesn't really fully exist. And I think it will probably be slow.
And we have imbued people with the sense that if you're not doing well, it's probably your fault. And that is part of the American psyche. So it's hard to get people en masse together to really understand that a lot of these things are structurally kind of put up in their way. Well, Jamie McCallum, a very important book and a very important topic, Essential, How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight, and it will continue, for worker justice. I thank you so much for being with us today here on America Trends.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.